Okay, well, Stephen passes out the pop quiz, then. No, it's not. It might look like one when you first look at it. It's actually just the opposite. It's the cheat sheet. That is, I've sort of noticed over the last few weeks that sometimes it's easy to get lost in the names that I'm going over. We're talking about, especially for our visitors, the intertestamental period. A lot of history, a lot of names, a lot of people who are related to other people. And we're getting down to where the people start, some of them, or their descendants start appearing in the Bible. And so there's a two-page cheat sheet that I've put together for you. One side is labeled the Maccabean family tree. That's the things we've been talking about. You'll recognize the names at the top: Mattathias, his son Judas Maccabee, his brothers Simon and Jonathan, Eleazar, if you don't remember, he's the one who died under the elephant. Then the grandchildren, John Hyrcanus. You know, these are the men we've been talking about. I thought, okay, I'll put the sheet together and you can sort of follow along. And when we get to the other side, it gets more complicated. The back side is Herod's family. The family of Herod the Great. And you actually, if you look at the Maccabee tree close enough down in the lower left-hand corner, you'll see Herod the Great, so you'll see how the two sides kind of fit together. Next week, I have been doing some reading assignments for you. We have one we'll talk about in a moment. For next week, on the side that says Herod's family, you'll notice there's several scriptures under different people. Watch it take time and read about the different people who are on that tree. It'll probably take us 2 weeks to talk about all the different people, maybe even three. But go ahead and read those things, get to know who these people are. Some of them you might realize are in the Bible, and I didn't have a scripture there. So if you want to go and find where they are in the Bible and add that scripture, that'll be something you can add to as we talk about them in class. I don't think I have all the Herodias or her daughter Salome's verses in there, or perhaps even some of the Herods. I don't have all the verses. So we'll talk about those people over the class in the next few weeks. We'll spend our few minutes, I don't even know if we'll take the full five that we normally take, just to talk about the Lesson 6 handout, if you had a chance to read it. It was a reading from Josephus. Josephus writes in the 1st century A.D., towards the end of the 1st century. He's a Roman collaborator. He surrendered his unit. He was a Pharisee. He surrendered his town. He surrendered his unit to the Romans, all in the hopes of preserving his life, which he succeeded in doing. He went to Rome, became a historian, trying to explain Jews to the Romans. The Romans thought Jews were kind of odd, and so he wrote things like Jewish history books to explain Judaism and Jewish heritage to Romans who had never heard of them. As you were reading, I asked you to keep in mind, if you did this reading, that Josephus doesn't always tell the truth. He likes covering up things that were problems because he doesn't want to try to explain problems to the Romans. He wants it to all seem good for the Romans. He covers up problems that he sees as problems, whether or not the Romans would have cared. You know, if he saw it as a problem, he makes up a story to correct the problem. And I asked when he read it, did you see any? This is all about the priesthood. He talks about the priesthood from the time of Aaron, the high priesthood, down to, well, hopefully what we'll get this evening. Did anyone see any obvious falsehoods or even some subtle falsehoods? Or just mistakes? He is human. He could easily have made awesome mistakes.
Glenn,
yeah.
One of the first things I noticed was that he says that
okay, yeah, it's a custom to be a descendant of Aaron. Yeah, he's making it at least for the Roman audience. not a law that had to be followed. But this is just the way we do things. But then you noticed, you should have realized he was making stuff up, because did he ever say that there was anyone who wasn't a descendant of Aaron who was priest? Now, he covers up all that. Everybody's a descendant of Aaron, doesn't matter who it is. Even though if the Jewish history clear that some of these men weren't descendants of Aaron, he said, oh yeah, they're descendants of Aaron, somehow. Anyone else see any others? In that same first paragraph, he says, high priests serve for life, but that was only Aaron and maybe the next generation. Then they started passing it on. And so we had 13 of them, which the Bible doesn't record 13 in that period. He says we had 13 of them. But he said they started, passing the high priesthood. So he's getting the idea of passing the high priesthood back further in time, giving it more authority. Realize we talked about the last couple of weeks, that actually didn't start until around 160 with the Greeks getting involved and started passing around the high priesthood. He takes Menelaus, who was a Hellenistic Greek, a Benjaminite, and confuses him, or intentionally puts him together with Onias, who are three different. There were three different men: Onias, his brother Jason, and Menelaus, who wasn't a descendant of Aaron. And he says Menelaus was Onias, and Jason wasn't the brother; he was some distant relative. And he confuses all these things just to try to make it sound more pleasant. I don't know that he actually succeeded, but what does that tell you about reading from Josephus for historical facts? He also gets the years wrong. He says how many years between Aaron and Solomon, and he's off by about 100.
Verify.
Verify. Yeah. Don't trust and always verify. Josephus is writing for Josephus. A lot of times Josephus apparently wrote from memory, which might be some of his mistakes, because he was in Rome, didn't always have all the scriptures and things that he would have wanted. So he made things up as he needed them. So don't always trust, a lot of people, I know a lot of people who study the scriptures like to go to Josephus. That's fine. Just remember that, you can take one page out of Josephus and you can start going through and saying, that's wrong, that's wrong, that's wrong. Be careful with it. It's not scripture. Okay, where we are in our story, history, I want to talk about the high priesthood a little bit tonight if we got a chance. We got down to Alexander on your cheat sheet. Now that you got a sheet, I can always go back to it to show you where we're talking about. He's listed as Alexander Janaeus, about in the center of the page. He was like his father and his grandfather. He was high priest and king. He was doing both. Remember, his father had wanted to split the high priesthood away from the kingship when he died, when John Hyrcanus died. But the son, Aristobulus, took over. Josephus called him Judas. But anyway, when Aristobulus took over, he killed his mom so that and tries to take both of them, and then he dies. And it goes to Alexander. So when Alexander dies, he names his wife Salome, not the one in the Bible, not the one you're used to. We'll get to her. But he names his wife, she was named after this Salome, names her to be the queen, and his son to be the high priest, Hyrcanus II. And she actually rules as queen. She's actually only the second ruling queen of Israel. Anyone remember the first? Athaliah, yeah. She was way better than Athaliah was. It couldn't have been much worse, right? Salome did a very good job as queen, apparently. But the Pharisees really loved her, because she broke up, the fact she was queen broke up the kingship and the high priesthood. The Pharisees thought that was the scriptural way. They shouldn't be the same office. And so the Pharisees were on her side, and she repaid them when she once again gathered the Sanhedrin, that ruling council or advisory council. Under the kings, it had been an advisory board to the kings. She configured it and gave half the seats to the Pharisees. And so it became basically an even split by party. If you're ever wondering why it always seems there's half and half, remember Paul points it out in Acts. He looked about and saw that it was about half and half. Sanhedrin was always half and half. Half the seats were reserved for Pharisees, half for Sadducees. That doesn't go with their a voting number. That's just half the seats went to each party. And the tie-breaking vote went to the high priest, who was always which party? Last week's lesson. Sadducees. So the Sadducees still had an advantage. But at the time of Queen Salome, they were only an advisory board, so they could only advise her. They couldn't overrule her. She appointed an interesting person for our story this week, next week, and actually into the Bible. An interesting man named Antipater. He was an Idumean, which means he was from which nation? Edom. An Idumean, a very wealthy man, who was so wealthy he actually managed to marry a relative of the king of Arabia, the Nabataeans, that was who ruled Arabia at the time. He married one of their noble women, and she appointed him to then be the governor of Judea for her, of Judah. His name was Antipater, and if you look on the back of your sheet, you'll see he is Herod's father. All right, you see how it all starts to tie together. She appoints him to be the governor of Judea, and it works well. The Nabataeans stop raiding. Up until that point, the Nabataeans had continually, year after year, raided the borders. But once they have a relative who's in charge of Judah, they stopped raiding the borders. But the problem was that Salome was rather old when she came, because her husband already died of old age, so she only rules for a few years, 9 years, before she passes on. And her son, in 67 BC, her son Hyrcanus II, the one who had been given the high priesthood, you see in the coin, the drawing from the coin, wearing the high priestly garments of that day, Hyrcanus took over the kingship. He said, well, mom died, didn't appoint a successor, it should be me. 3 months later, his brother in the lower picture, Aristobulus, said, no, it can't be you, you're high priest, you can't be high priest and king. Hyrcanus thought he could bring the Pharisees, and the Pharisees would bring the people, and he would go out and oppose his brother's army, Aristobulus's army. And when they got to the battlefield, the Pharisees simply walked over to join Aristobulus and brought all the people with him. And Hyrcanus realized, ooh, he didn't have anyone but the Sadducees on his side. And so he stepped down from being king. So he rules as king for a few months, and then he gives it over to his brother. His brother rules as king for only 4 years before he dies. And of course, when he dies, then Hyrcanus realizes he gets to be king after all. Now, I just sort of put a little list here of the high priest. I said we want to talk about high priest, or I did this evening. Jonathan, the brother of Simeon, was high priest for about 10 years. Josephus says it was 7, so I'm not going to argue one way or the other. Simeon, who had been king, that's the brother, again on the list of the Hasmonean family there. Simeon becomes high priest as well as king for about 8 years. Then his son, John Hyrcanus, becomes high priest for about 30 years. Then Aristobulus, just for less than a year. Then Alexander, we just looked at again, all these men, high priest and king, from Simeon down to Alexander. And then John Hyrcanus actually is high priest for 36 years. On and off, he's various other things. Antigonus, the son of Aristobulus II, you have to go back up, he's a brother. He wasn't ever high priest himself, but Antigonus rules for a few years as high priest, And then we'll talk about probably next week or the week after a non Hasmonean, Hananel, becomes high priest. He's not even from Israel. He's a Babylonian Jew. Why would there be Jews in Babylon? Yeah, a lot of them were from those who didn't come back from the exile. Right? So there was still a big Jewish community in Babylon. Herod's actually the one who appoints Hananel. And people think he did it because he was trying to appeal to the Babylonian Jews to come and support him. Eventually he gives it back to Aristobulus III, and then he changes his mind, just as he did earlier. He ends up killing Aristobulus III and Antigonus. We'll talk about all the murdering that Herod did in a later lesson, probably about 2 weeks from now. These are the ones up until, you know, the beginning, right up to the beginning of his reign. Now in 63 BC, when we're getting to the end of the two brothers, let me get back to that. What was the Aristobulus II and his brother Hyrcanus, is when Pompey the Great appears in Jerusalem. I said Aristobulus II died. He didn't quite die. He'll get killed here in a little bit, but. Pompey the Great comes in. He's actually there fighting off the Seleucid Empire. This is his great achievement. Remember, he's one of the three, the triumvirate, you know, Julius Caesar, Pompey the Great, and their banker Crassus. He takes control of the Seleucid Empire, and he decides, well, that means he also has control of Judea, because, remember, Judea was paying a tribute to the Seleucid Empire. So Pompey comes down to Judea, just expecting Judea to recognize him as their ruler, and instead Aristobulus thought he could recreate the Maccabean experience, and he led an army out to fight the Romans, and it didn't last hardly any time at all. The Romans weren't the Greeks, and Pompey certainly wasn't any of the kings of the Greeks. He quickly defeated Aristobulus, took him captive, added him to his baggage train of those going back to Rome so he could march him through the streets of Rome.
His family,
yeah. Hyrcanus, being perhaps a good politician, or actually Antipater being the good politician, Antipater went and got Hyrcanus when Aristobulus went to fight the Romans. And Antipater said, "Let's join the Romans." And they put together what supplies they could, got some men together, got some money together, and they went around their brother and gave it to the Romans, told the Romans, "Hey, you know, this guy's going to come and fight you." Pompey wasn't taken by surprise. But he rewarded them anyway. He thought, well, that was a nice thing for them to do. He allowed Hyrcanus to continue to be the high priest, even gave him the title of ethnarch, that is, ruler of a people. That is, he's the ruler of the Jews, but he's not making him king. Pompey wasn't ready to make him king. We'll talk about that reason in a while. One of the reasons, though, is that he did not want to give him what the Romans call the right of the sword. Anyone know what that means? Got a few from them. Yeah, okay.
Right to do execution and meet out justice.
Okay, one of the things the right of the sword includes is capital punishment. If you had the right of the sword, you had the right to kill. And this is something the Romans were very cautious about, which people they gave the right to kill other people. The other thing the right of the sword entailed was military. Who had the right to lead military troops, both inside the nation and outside the nation? So those are sort of the three parts of the right of the sword. And so he gave him the title ethnarch. They're your people, but we're not giving you any of the rights. You don't get to use any of those rights because we don't trust you. We just took over. Instead, they put the territory under the Syrian governor, And the Syrian governor then divided it up. He said it's too much to manage. He divided it up into five districts, which continued much longer than the Syrian governor probably ever imagined. He broke it up into Judea, Samaria, Galilee. That's going from south to north on the east side of the Jordan. And to Decapolis and Iturea. Decapolis is your area just across the Jordan River. And Iturea, Chalcis, is that area up further north that we hardly ever talk about. He said, okay, all those areas, they're all split up. Gave each one of their own Sanhedrin, that is their own ruling council. And each council would then report to the great Sanhedrin in Jerusalem, led by the high priest, who is also ethnarch. And they would then report to the governor. And that's how the governor of Syria sort of set it up. And you start to see the political power now that the great Sanhedrin has. I mean, they're not ruling, but they have a lot of influence. Then in Roman history, Julius Caesar and Pompey had an argument, both accusing the other of trying to take over around 48 BC. Caesar thought Pompey had too much power between Egypt, Syria, Judea, all the Seleucid Empire. And he said he was going to bring Aristobulus II back to be his puppet king. He was going to kick out Hyrcanus and put in Aristobulus. Pompey had some friends in Rome who quickly poisoned Aristobulus to make sure he didn't come back. Caesar then said that Pompey had committed treason, same thing that Mark Antony had been charged with. And Caesar then put together an army. Pompey fled to Egypt to ask for help from the Ptolemies because he had kept them on the throne. He said, hey, you know, I need an army. I need one fast. And the Ptolemy who was in charge at that point thought, hey, you know, Caesar's got a bigger army. I'll just kill Ptolemy. And so when Caesar lands with a very small army, his big army was still quite a ways behind him. When he lands, Ptolemy presents Caesar with a bloody head of his closest friend Pompey. And then presents him with the signet ring from Pompey's hand. And Caesar breaks down and cries. And then orders Ptolemy to be removed. I guess it's sort of like the men who thought they would please David. You know. Oh, look, I killed your friend. Didn't work for the Ptolemies either. And instead, Julius Caesar put Cleopatra VII on the throne. And yes, finally, that's the Cleopatra in all the movies. That's the one we always hear about. Caesar put her on the throne in place of her brother. But when Caesar did this, I said he arrived with a very small army. And he's now removed the Ptolemy leader. He didn't kill him. He just had him removed from office. He went out and got his own army. Pompey's forces were still around because Pompey died there. And he brings all of those to attack Caesar. And once again, Antipater, being a very astute person, puts together a Judean army and charges to Caesar's rescue. And he gets there just a few days before Caesar's army lands. So he just barely made it in time to actually have rescued Caesar. But at that point, Antipater said, hey, I rescued Caesar. And Caesar then rewards Hyrcanus for allowing it, lets him keep his position. But he actually appoints Antipater to the position of Roman procurator. We'll talk about what the titles mean later, but basically it means this. He was in charge of all the money in Judea. Right? Procurator was the money man. He got to handle all the revenue that came in and all the pay that went out, including his own. All except for the treasury of the temple. Everything else went through the procurator. And Caesar gave him a very limited right of the sword. He let him control the local military because he's already proved to be loyal to Caesar. So he could have a local military for local problems, bandits and whatever. Not for external problems, not for judging yet. Now here's what I really wanted to discuss, which is how Romans understood the high priesthood. How the Roman government understood the high priesthood. They thought of it as a political office. All right, what do we think of it as? A spiritual, a religious office, right? To the Romans, priesthoods were political. In Rome, you became priest as a political obligation. You could work your way up the city political spectrum. You could work your way up the military, or you could work your way up the religious political spectrum. All of them are considered completely acceptable, and you could move from one to the other. All right? They had different layers, different levels in each of those different ways of rising in politics. But a religious way was just another political office. It's a political office that required certain duties, just like a military commander has certain duties, just like a city administrator has certain duties. The duties of the political priest were religious duties. Yes, you had to be there at certain sacrifices, you had to do certain rituals, but they thought of it all as political. You did this because you held the office and this is the job. Different priesthoods had more prestige. You might imagine some of them, like those of war, were considered really prestigious. In order to get those offices, actually any of the offices, military, city, or religious, usually you had to buy your way in, or have family connections to get you in, or you had to pay back with favors. You know, I'll do this for you if you help me get this, you know, this job over here. And then once you got the first job, then you had to work your way to the next job. And you paid it off with favors to the people of influence who could help you to get that next job. And oddly, the Roman high priest up until Julius Caesar, the Pontifex Maximus, that's what the name is, high priest. The high priest in Rome was actually considered one of the worst jobs there was. Sounds funny, doesn't it? High priest is the worst job. Because even though he was priest, technically over all the priesthoods, he actually didn't have a lot of worshipers because he didn't have a god. He was the priest over the others, but he didn't have a god of his own. The Vestal Virgins were underneath the Pontifex Maximus, but you know, other than that, he really didn't have a lot of followers. And therefore, different people paid him small sums, and it wasn't considered very prestigious. Julius Caesar began his career very poor, trading on family favors. He became Pontifex Maximus, and then he leveraged it to start forcing priests to pay him bigger sums. It's a whole different story. You can read Caesar's life. But anyway, he leveraged that into becoming both a military commander, and he continued to keep the title. He thought it was a great title, Pontifex Maximus. He was the highest priest. And he started using it like a king would. Made a lot of money being Pontifex Maximus. And as he died, he passed that title along with the emperor. Passed the title to his son, to the next, to the next, to the next. Anyone know who holds it today? Caesar's held it until 470, or their descendants. Yeah, the Pope has it today. In 470, when they were being run out of Rome by the invading Ostrogoths, I believe it was, or Visigoths, they surrendered the title and gave it to the Bishop of Rome. Said, here, you can have the title. We're taking off to Constantinople. And so that's where the title change came. But up until that point, it was a political office who felt he was over everyone, including... Now think about it, the Romans just conquered Judea. They have a different religion. Who do they think's in charge of that religion? The Pontifex Maximus. Their own high priest is higher than the high priest of Judaism. That's just another religion, like, you know, worshiping the war god. They worship their own god, that's fine. But I'm in charge. And you can start to see how the Romans were thinking. Later, Constantine, when he, you know, says that you can have your own church just as long as I'm the one who's in charge. He was Pontifex Maximus. He thought of himself as the one in charge of the church. So they understood that the Jewish priests, just like their own priesthood, that is, they thought of them as needing to pay bribes, because that's the way the Romans did it. You wanted to be priest, you got to pay for it. Either give me a good favor, do something for me, like Hyrcanus did, right? Caesar appointed him because he saved him, just as Pompey had done. If you want to keep it, you might have to continue to pay cash. Whatever Roman was in charge of Judea, like the governor of Syria, would felt that he was working for the Pontifex Maximus and could then change high priest as he needed to. What the Romans did to enforce this is they said that the high priestly garments, you know, the ones that the Old Testament talks about, they had to be kept in the Roman tower in Jerusalem. And before the high priest could take them out, he had to ask for them in advance, no spur of the moment thing. He had to petition for them in advance, kind of like checking out from the library, right? He had to ask for it in advance, come and get them the day of the ritual, put them on, and promptly return them at the end of the ritual. Right, the Romans were keeping very tight reins on, because they thought, well, you're not really a high priest if you're not wearing the garments. That's how the Romans understood Jewish high priesthood. And therefore, if they wanted to change high priests, they just wouldn't give you the garments anymore. They'd give you the garments. Right? So you're not high priest because I'll give you the garments when you want them. And in some ways, that was true. Remember the Sadducees we talked about? They were a political body. They worked in a political body. The Great Sanhedrin was a political body. And the high priesthood, the Sadducees loved it because if you were high priest, the Romans allowed you to keep all the money that came into the treasury to use as you saw fit, because that's how the Roman system worked. If you were the priest over the temple, money that came in was yours. You could pay your own lower priest if you wanted lower priest. If you didn't want any, you could keep it all yourself. If you wanted to make your temple more grand, you could use it for that. It was your money. And so you can imagine people who bought the office, then started keeping the money, and if you needed to buy another year, you take it out of the treasury, right? One of the favors, though, the Romans required of the high priests was that they had to keep the peace. One of the things Romans hated was rebellion. And so if the high priest couldn't keep the peace, the Romans would change high priests. So it doesn't matter how much you paid in the bribe. If you didn't keep the peace, you were out. Somebody else came in. And under the Romans, the high priesthood changed a lot. I'm not going to go through all these names and stories, but just going from where we left off with Ananel, or also called Hananiel, the Babylonian, you see the first one serves 1 year, the next one serves less than a year, the next one serves 6 years, the next one serves 7 years. Then we actually have Boethus, we'll talk about probably next week, who serves 18 years. His son only serves a few months. Matthias, who serves only less than a year. Joseph, who serves only 1 day. The Day of Atonement. The guy before him, Matthias, accidentally got himself ritually unclean the night before. Didn't know the rules. The Pharisees threw a fit when, you know, they realized he had been unclean the night before. And the Romans, because it looked like a rebellion was about to start, the Romans stepped in and said, okay, you're out, you're in. Actually, it was Herod the Great working for the Romans. Said, you know, okay, this guy's out, he's no longer high priest, this guy's the new high priest. And as soon as the day was over, he said, okay, you're no longer high priest, I got to give it to my brother-in-law. That's the way it worked under Herod. He was the one appointing in that case. His son Archelaus appoints a few men. You'll notice none of them survived more than a few days, except for the last one. A few years, I mean. Then there's Annas in the Bible called Annas. Annas was actually a high priest for 9 years. Annas was the beginning of the group of really the Sadducees taking back over the high priesthood. Annas led a body of men who were wealthy merchants who could pay for the priesthood. Annas paid for himself for many years. Then one of the others, Phabi, paid. Didn't last very long because of a rebellion. Eleazar, the son of Annas, Annas didn't want to be high priest again, but he paid for his son to become high priest. But again, it didn't last very long. Then there's a Simon. Then there's Caiaphas. Caiaphas actually manages to keep the peace for 18 years. And he's the one, of course, that we read about mostly in the New Testament. You hear Annas, occasionally called high priest, but remember, he's a former high priest. And Caiaphas, who was the high priest at the time. Remember, none of these men were descendants of Aaron, though. After Caiaphas, then Annas actually appoints two of his other sons as high priest. Again, if you had enough money, you could get the high priesthood. And Annas was very good at appointing his sons as high priests. Bothus, one of his sons, comes back in. Then another son of Annas comes back in towards the bottom there. Not for very long, for less than a year. Then there's a whole group of other men. Most of them, you know, just look up there. Most of them are just less than a year. They get the high priesthood. Sometimes that's all they can afford. They pay for it for a year. They get to be high priest. They step down. Others, you know, because of rebellions and other things, they got kicked out. One interesting case is Ananias. He's two up from the Agrippa the second group. And he's also the first one under Agrippa the second. He was appointed high priest. And then he was charged with rebelling against Caesar. And he appealed to Caesar. He went all the way to Rome. He fought the charges. It took him 3 years in courts before they finally cleared him of the charges. He returned home to find that somebody else was already high priest, another son of Annas. He waited until that son was removed, and then he appointed himself. He said, now I'm high priest because I never left. The Romans appointed somebody else. They appointed Ishmael because he's the one who paid. And so we had two high priests simultaneously, one self-appointed and one appointed by the Romans. And it becomes interesting, you can see the rest of the names, it becomes interesting because it actually plays into something that happens in the New Testament. Actually, some of this, a couple of things play into it. Somebody turn to John 18, read 19 to 24. And somebody else can be turning to Acts 23. We'll get there in a moment. Verse 24 points out, Annas wasn't the high priest. Even though the guard who slaps Jesus says, do you speak to the high priest that way? And Jesus doesn't respond at all to that question. It may be because Jesus doesn't recognize Annas to be high priest. He actually hadn't been high priest for over 20 years at this point. So, you know, it's a bit hard to still call him the high priest. Another interesting incident is in Acts 23.
Law, and you command me to destroy the property of law,
Okay, there's a lot of ways to interpret this little interchange between Paul and Ananias. I just want to point out, this is the Ananias I was just talking about, who at this point, 58 AD roughly, was self-appointed high priest. He wasn't the one the Romans recognized as high priest. So Paul could be saying, you know, you're not the real high priest. You know, I spoke to him that way. The guy asked, you know, would you speak evil of the high priest? Paul says, no, I wouldn't speak evil of the high priest. I mean, you could take that to being saying, you know, I didn't know he was high priest because, you know, this other guy's the guy who's supposed to be appointed. It could be he's saying, I didn't know Ananias had become high priest. That's how some people interpret it. That as Paul's been traveling, he's just got back. It might be news to him that Ananias was claiming to be high priest again. Remember, he's not wearing any special garments because you had to ask the Romans for the garments. And that didn't include political meetings of the Sanhedrin. That was only for rituals. So Paul could simply be saying, hey, I didn't know he was high priest. I didn't recognize him. Or he could be saying, he's not really a high priest at all. He's saying, yes, I won't speak evil of the ruler of my people, but you know, this guy ain't one. I mean, he's not a descendant of Aaron. He might be making sort of the comment, you know, none of these guys are really high priests. Others take it as Paul just simply, you know, bad eyesight, didn't recognize who he was. But I think it's probably, may have been more of a political statement, because Paul likes those political statements, you know, when he recognizes Sadducees against Pharisees. This could have been a little dig at Ananias. We only got like a minute left, so I didn't get where I wanted to get tonight. So, questions or comments?
Yeah. It's expedient one man should not have people.
Yeah, Caiaphas?
Yeah, Caiaphas. Obviously, none of these guys are legitimate high priests.
Not in the Aaron sense, yeah.
Right. But, and yet, in that sense, the Lord still worked through.
Right. The Lord, you know, calls prophets. You know, to be a prophet didn't mean you necessarily were a good person, it just means God chose you to speak through. When we get Balaam, you know, God speaks through him, even though Balaam was trying to curse the people of Israel at the same time. You know, but he was still a prophet of God because God chose to work through him, and he was going to tell the word of God. So, in this case, Caiaphas actually said the right thing and apparently said it under the influence of God. You know, he said what was going to take place.